Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Leslie Budowitz writes two culinary mystery series, the Food Lover's Village series and the Spice Shop series. Her latest book is Better Off Dead. She's also an attorney whose nonfiction book, Books, Crooks, and Counselors, is an indispensable reference for mystery writers. In December 2006, we published her short story, The End of the Line. Leslie reads that story for us today, and following the reading, she talks a little bit about her books and her inspirations. Here's Leslie Budowitz reading The End of the Line.
Everyone left Kena. Sooner or later, one way or another, everyone left the village. Its gray stone towers had housed the Maniot people for centuries. Its terraced fields had grown their olives and grapes. Its steep hillside pastures had fed the goats that gave them meat and milk and cheese. Scores of tourists, Greeks and foreigners, drove fast cars through the Mani's narrow roads, stopping to gawk at the towers and marvel at the sea, the wild Mediterranean. They came, and they left. Demetra had left once. At first, Cyprian counted the months on his fingers, but when the girl had been gone more months than his hands could tell, he'd stopped counting. When the seasons had gone full circle, and the olive trees were once again to flower. He realized he did not want to know how long his daughter, his only surviving child, had been gone. He'd only wanted her to return. But now the girl's wandering and her wandering were over. In the truest spirit of the Maniot, the people of the god Ares, he had done what was necessary, and she would stay. Life had been hard for Cyprian, but he had known its blessings. His Sophia, what a blessing she had been. With soft eyes and hair as dark as the shadows of midnight, she was just a teenager herself when Cyprian married her. He was older, not long back from the civil war that had followed the Italian and German invasions. His eyes bore the scars of battle, and so did his heart, and even though the village girls knew they could no longer be choosy about husbands, not one of those starry maidens dreamed of marrying Cyprian. Until Sophia. Cyprian leaned back in his wooden chair, its blue paint chipped and worn, but still as bright as the sky over Kena on the day she had accepted his proposal. He could see her laughing up at him, a hand trailing through the blood-red poppies, her heart one with his. Only death could take Sophia from him, or from Kena, and it finally had. She lay in her grave 100 meters above the village, on the same hillside where they'd buried their sons, Nicholas, the eldest, dead of a fever at 2. Then, years later, Pavlo. Cyprian's heart had nearly broken when the sure-fired youth, raised on the rocks like a goat, fell from a stone wall and tumbled like the pod of a thistle toward the sea. How long had it been? He could not say. Sophia had taught him long ago to leave the carving of notches in the doorframe for happy times, for the blessed memories, she'd said, the ones God gives us to keep us company. Their deaths had left Cyprian with his fields, his herd, his stone towers, and his treasure, Demetra. Ah, Demetra, the child of his old age. So much like her mother, it made his heart weep to see her among the olive trees, in the garden, or resting against the kitchen doorway. She was a good girl who did as she was told. Like the other village girls, she had little schooling, but Pavlo had taught her to read and write in Greek, and she spoke the language better than Cyprian did. He was a Maniot and preferred the old tongue. After Sophia's death, the girl took over her mother's chores, and the house ran almost as well. Better in some ways, he had to admit. But a few seasons after Sophia died, the summer the fires raged through the Mani, an ugly spirit rose up in the girl. Cyprian blamed the fires. They blazed through the drought-stricken olive groves and scorched the earth that had fed so many Maniot for so long. They destroyed the vines, the fields, the gardens. They blackened the famed stone towers at Vathia almost beyond recognition. They conquered the Mani in ways no foreign army ever could. And behind them came the strangers, and Demetra's questions. Whenever foreigners stopped in Kena, Demetra greeted them. Mainland Greeks came to fight the fires, and Demetra asked questions. Men came from the European Union with talk of money for reforestation, for rebuilding, and Demetra asked questions. Albanians came to work the stone, with skills only the ablest of the Maniot men still possessed, and Demetra asked questions. He, old Cyprian, never ill a day in his life except for the fevers from the war wounds, became sickened by her questions, by her talk of leaving. "Papa," Demetra said, "why should I stay? There's nothing here. Nothing in all of Mani." "Nothing?" he shouted. "You know nothing. Everything is here. The sea, the sky, the goats, burrows, olive trees. The village your family built, where we've lived for centuries." She shook her fist at him and at the gray stone tower that was their home, high above the narrow road that wound through the town. So angry at him that she forgot to close the pine shutter of her bedroom at the top of the tower, letting the sun glint off the glass. "A sailor would go blind," he told her. "There is no future here," she said. "Nothing to do but what you've always done. That's no life for a girl." "It was good enough for your mother." "For Sophia." Her face softened. She tilted her head, and a wisp of black hair loosened from her scarf. For a moment, he forgot who she was. "Sophia," he said softly, his hand reaching toward her. "Papa," she said. "Life in Kena was enough for Mama because she had you." And that had been true. Cyprian and Sophia fit together like stone against stone at the base of a tower. They had been the life and foundation, the joy of Kena for 41 years. No need of notches to remember that. He feared he would lose his daughter, despite his insistence that her future belonged in the Mani. Her desire to see the world beyond these hills burned just as strong. Cyprian would not prevent Demetra from going to another village on the peninsula, to Lagio or even Catronet. How else could she meet an eligible boy, a Mani boy like his Pavlo, dead too young, or Nicholas, who had had no chance to live? It was up to Demetra to carry on the family line, though if she didn't marry, he would understand. Not many young men were left in the Mani. Pavlo had left once. He'd made it all the way to Sparta and come back with nothing but a 12-gauge shotgun and dissatisfaction with everything Mani. Cyprian could not bear such a loss again. "You belong here," he told his daughter. "You have no need to be anywhere else." "Papa, you have no need, but me..." She pointed at her heart, her cheeks flushed, the red of the setting sun. "I want to see more." "No one has ever conquered the Mani," he replied, as though that were reason enough. And she tossed her dish towel on the table in exasperation. The spring moon was full. In its pale light, Demetra placed her feet with care between the crocuses and irises lining the old burrow trail, ever mindful of the tragedy that had befallen her family here when Pavlo stumbled to his death. Pavlo, elder brother, much loved, much missed. She had never known Nicholas, dead long before she was born. How different life would be if one of them had lived. Papa would still fiercely maintain that her place was here, among the rocks, the wind, and the sea, that she would have an advocate, a younger voice, a male voice, to plead her case. She spread her skirt with care and settled on a rock wall overlooking the village and the sea beyond. She loved Kena, no question. She had no desire to leave here forever, just for a while. "A little while, Papa," she'd begged over and over. "A few months, a year. Let me take a job with a family watching children, or in a school." Over and over he tried to make her see there was no use for such a world. They had everything they needed here in Kena, here on the Mani, the southern tip of the Peloponnese, the farthest south one could go without crossing to an island. Outsiders thought it harsh and desolate. They were weak. Papa was strong, and so was Demetra, because they were Mani. She turned her gaze to the south, where moonlight softened the hard edges of the square towers and turned the stone almost golden. This was her home. Her ancestors had built the tower houses stone by stone. They'd cleared the slopes and built the terraces like the ones she sat on. They had planted the trees and nurtured them. Out on the water, a ship moved slowly across the horizon. Her heart quickened. Her friend Melina had found a job on a tourist ship. Dimitra had saved the postcards sent from ports around the world, names she was not sure how to pronounce. Le Havre, Copenhagen, Bristol, St. Petersburg, Miami. And Istanbul, the name that would send her father into a rage at the vile Turks, even though the only Turk she had ever met had been a road worker, young and handsome. Her father had raged for days after seeing her talk with the Turk at the taverna where she waited tables. The road work must have ended then, because she had seen the Turk no more. Dimitra knelt beside the terrace and pulled out a loose stone. Behind, in the secret space, lay the olive wood box Pavlo had carved for her 10th birthday. She slid it out, sat once more on the stone wall, and removed the lid. One by one, she looked lovingly at the postcards. She didn't need Copenhagen or Miami. Athens would do, or Navlian. Perhaps she could work in Monemvasia, in a taverna or one of the small hotels. She'd heard talk of the village at the head of a causeway and the ancient settlement, now partly restored, where people came from all over Europe and even America to hike and swim and watch the sea. A different sea. That's all she wanted, a taste of something different. She slipped the folded drachmas out of her skirt pocket and put them in the box between Istanbul and Lisbon. Almost enough now for the plan she and Eleni were making. When Dimitra looked up, the horizon was empty. The ship had sailed on. Every now and then, late in the evening, Cyprian took himself to the taverna to sit on the terrace outside, to share a bottle of ouzo and the talk of men. "I saw that Dimitra of yours coming into the village this morning," Milos said as Cyprian topped off the small green glasses that dotted the table. "Wildflowers in her hair. What a sight, that girl." "A sight," Petros agreed, "like your Sophia." "Ah, Sophia. May she rest in peace," they all thought, though no one said the words. To speak them was to acknowledge the pain, and that they could not do. The old men puffed on their cigarette, drank more ouzo, talked about everything, talked about nothing. Their sons, their grandsons, their women. The olive crop, the health of the goats and cattle, last year's retsina. The change in the winds as the seasons cycled round. A gray cat missing the tip of one ear wove between their legs, searching for crumbs of dense yellow bread or a dropped bit of cheese. Finally, Kostas set his glass down hard on the scarred wooden table and leaned forward, shaking his finger at Cyprian. "You are a selfish old man, refusing to let your daughter live her own life." Cyprian's jaw tightened, and above his deeply veined nose, his eyes grew sharp. "You want to keep her here," Kostas continued, "baking your bread and herding your goats. I don't blame you for wanting the company. Your wife is dead, and so are your sons. But your days will come to an end sooner than you think, and what will happen to your beautiful young Dimitra then, when she is no longer young or beautiful?" Under his sun-burnished skin, Cyprian's sagging cheeks flushed. "And who are you to talk? Your daughter, that Melina, she'll marry some Frenchman, or a Spaniard, if she marries at all, and you'll never know your grandchildren. She's a good girl, my Melina. She sends me a postcard every week." "And you think that means she'll come back and be content here?" Cyprian waved his hand. "Never." Kostas shook his head once, dismissing Cyprian's doubts, and pushed back from the table, his chair scraping against the worn stone floor. "Children are like birds," Milos said. He was the father of two daughters, each now with growing families. Indeed, when Milos was in his fields or at his stone tower, his children and grandchildren flocked round him eagerly. "You cannot hold them too tightly. They are born to fly." Milos's flowery talk set Cyprian ablaze. "You are fools. You know nothing. You are as stubborn as my black goat." Kostas threw himself back into the fray. "I should send that goat over to you. Trailing him through the mountains will keep you nimble. You can wait for him at night like you wait for your daughter." With those words, the rage that had fueled Mani warriors for generations spilled over. "Old man!" Cyprian shouted, rising from his chair so suddenly that it tipped over behind him, narrowly missing the gray cat. "You have insulted me for the last time!" White-haired Petros put a gnarled hand on Cyprian's forearm. "Calm yourself," he said, in the manner of a man who has known another for decades and drunk the fruit of many vines with him. Sit. Breathing heavily, Cyprian glared at the others. Petros righted the chair with one hand, the other still holding back his friend. Sit, Petros repeated. He means nothing against your name or your honor. Cyprian lowered himself into the chair, grabbed his glass and downed the liquor, poured another and gripped it tight, his eyes locked with those of the man across the table, always the friend who dared to challenge him, always the friend who was not a friend. Milos lit a cigarette from the pack that lay between them. Costas speaks too bluntly, but he speaks the truth. No, no, he said, and held out a hand as Cyprian made to interrupt. We all see how your Demetra walks the hillside. It's nothing, we know that. She's alone. Who could a young girl meet anywhere near Kina? The men exchanged glances and nods. She's looking at the stars. She's dreaming. She's picking wild crocuses and orchids by moonlight. She is a gift from the heavens. You are right to cherish her. Milos took a puff and fell silent. Petros refilled the glasses. But Costas is also right to question you, Milos continued, his words cutting through the cloud of blue smoke that hovered above the table. The men were alone on the terrace. Only the owner remained inside, washing glasses and ashtrays. The fates have denied you the chance to watch your sons grow old. Even so, your daughter deserves a future. Cyprian stirred, and Petros laid a reassuring hand on his arm. I have a solution, Milos said. A nephew, the nephew of a cousin. His father has more sons than land, and I have been considering hiring him to work with me. Milos's daughters had married men with land of their own, and while Milos would be happy to share his land with his sons-in-law, the old men all understood his sympathy with the nephew who had no prospects. Cyprian stared at the table, at the bottle, at his glass, not wanting to agree with the unspoken proposition. Finally, he reached for his glass. Does this boy walk upright? Does he have two eyes, two ears, two balls? Will he treat her well? He drank deeply, and the other men all laughed and clapped each other on the back. The nephew could come, and Cyprian would take a look. And life would go on as it should, in Kina, in the land of the Mani. Demetra's father had not told her Georgios was coming, nor said anything about a possible match. Still, all of Kina knew everything about the young man, whether it was true or not, long before he arrived, and how could she not wonder? Would he be like the kind, gentle Milos, handsome despite his years and stooped spine? Or would he be completely unsuitable, barely able to talk to a goat, let alone a pretty girl of 17? No, she persuaded herself, how could I possibly be happy with a boy who wants to live here? And yet she did love Kina. In the spring, when the olive groves blossomed and the air smelled so sweet, the hillside covered with crocuses and anemone, how could any place be more beautiful? After her shift at the taverna, before it was time to make her father's evening meal, Demetra went to collect the goats. And there, on a terrace not far from the spot where she liked to dream, sat a boy, a young man, of maybe 19 or 20. His skin was dark, his hair curly, and even from a distance she could tell his jaw was strong and his eyes swift. Georgios turned in her direction, and the quick tilt of his head told her he had seen her. It was the goat's bell that caught his attention, she thought, not the touch of my gaze. He stood, and the gesture told her he knew who she was, and liked what he saw. Georgios and Demetra fetched the goats together every evening for the next few weeks. As the young people trailed the small herd toward the terrace behind the tower, Cyprian felt a burden ease. He trundled inside and up to the small chamber he had shared with Sophia. Her lace scarf still lay on the bureau, her icon hanging above it. And in a frame he had carved himself, a photo of his bride on their wedding day so many years ago. You see, I was right, he told her picture. We will have a bride again soon, almost as beautiful as you. He sat at the foot of the bed, the photo in hand, until darkness fell and the smells of his dinner cooking rose through the tower. Slowly he stood, kissed the photo and replaced it, then kissed the icon. When he descended into the main room, he saw his daughter standing in front of the stone sink, back to him, head bowed over her hands. Demetra, he began. Papa, she said, spinning around and shoving something he could not see into her skirt pocket. He could not see, but he could guess. He held out his arms, a smile crinkling on his leathered face. You don't need to count your money, girl. You think me a poor man, and I am, but I have been planning for this day. Don't you worry. Your old father can afford a pretty wedding for his only daughter. Papa, no, not a wedding. Her mouth tightened, and she closed her eyes. When they opened a moment later, they were damp. No, Papa, no. She turned and ran out the tower door. Cyprian ate the stew she had left and watered the goats. He sat in front of the tower and waited. The stars rose. The moon rose. He slept in his hard chair and woke and slept again a dozen times. Demetra was gone. She sent a message through a neighbor, one whose own children had gone, to Scutari, to Stupa, and Calamari, and who did not care enough to complain. Cyprian complained. He complained to the neighbor, to the walls of the house and the village, to the olive trees and the goats. He complained to Petros and Costas and to the keeper of the taverna. He complained to Milos that his nephew was good for nothing, though he had to admit the young man worked hard, talked easily, and seemed like the right kind of boy. After Cyprian had complained long enough and loud enough, he tended the garden and tried to forget the girl. But the Mani had lived here nearly 800 years, and he could not forget. He tended his goats, he trimmed his vines and plucked his olives. He watched the sea and the stars, and every night he spoke to Sophia with sadness in his heart. And then, one day, Demetra returned. He hardly recognized her, her head uncovered, her hair flowing long and loose. She wore a gauzy white blouse, like the gown Sophia had worn on their wedding night, and a dark skirt. At least it was a skirt, not trousers, though it came just to her knees and showed her calves and her trim ankles in their leather sandals. Tiny gold loops pierced her ears. She was lovely, this outsider, his daughter. She approached him shyly at first, then rushed forward, throwing her arms around him. He wanted to brush her away, but he could not. Demetra had come home. The young man with her worried him. Andreas, he was called. He spoke only Greek, so Demetra translated. A fisherman from a village on the island of Hydra, from a family that had always fished. He stared at the stone villages of the Mani as if they were strange. They were in love, they said, and intended to make their lives on the island. Papa, be happy for me, she pleaded. Cyprian could only nod his head and worry. He watched from the tower yard as Demetra walked Andreas up the hill to the graves of her mother and her brothers, to the stone terrace where she'd sat so many hours, longing for another world. Though he couldn't see the goats, he heard their bells tinkling on the afternoon breeze as they rushed to her, and he heard Demetra and Andreas laughing. It was good to have her home. And yet fear gripped Cyprian's heart. At last they returned, Andreas cradling a small kid in his arms. Papa, the kid has an injured foot, Demetra said. Cyprian grunted, goat meat stew tonight. No, sir, please, Andreas said in Greek that Demetra translated. The leg's not fully broken. I can bind the bone with a splint and a cloth, and it will heal. What does a fisherman know? Cyprian's displeasure needed no translation, though the young man's response did. I've cared for animals all my life, sir. I have an ointment in my pack that will speed the healing. Papa, please, Demetra said. Let him try. And Cyprian could not say no. Demetra insisted Cyprian go to the taverna for supper with them. The keeper's wife made the most tender lamb, the spiciest eggplant, the sweetest tzatziki. The neighbors in the town greeted her, shared wine, smiled and laughed, approving of the beautiful girl and the young man who spoke politely and could scarcely take his eyes off her. And yet, Cyprian could take no pleasure in the food or in the joy of his daughter's return. That night, on the front terrace, Andreas brought out a bottle of ouzo, a gift for the old man. They all drank from Sophia's tiny glasses, but Cyprian would not drink a second glass. That would mean he accepted the young man and his intentions. The moon rose. The young people bid him good night and walked up the hillside to say their own good night. Demetra climbed to her room in the tower, and her young man headed for the goat shed to bed down in the loft. On the terrace, in the blue chair with the woven reed seat, Cyprian poured a second glass from the bottle and stared at the sea and the sky. The moon and his heart told him what he must do. The next morning, the girl sat on the stone threshold, her hair uncombed, her blouse untucked. "Papa," she sobbed, "Andreas is gone." Cyprian's heart lurched at the sound of her tears, the way it lurched at Sophia's tears when Pavlo died. "Hush, girl, he was no good for you." When Cyprian returned from the hillside that evening, the pine table held the fresh yellow bread he loved and a bowl of country salad. He smelled the tomatoes and eggplant of Masaka baking and knew he had done the right thing. But the table was set for one, and Demetra did not eat or drink. She dabbed at her face with a crisp white handkerchief of her mother's. "He said he loved me. We planned to be married and love each other, like you and Mama." A brief stab of regret tore into Cyprian's heart. He tapped a small cask of Retsina, his homemade wine, and shoved a glass toward his daughter. "Drink. It will heal your heart." But nothing seemed to heal her heart. Georgios came to visit, and she sat, silent, showing no interest in his talk of the fields or the animals. After a few visits, he did not return. She spent the days staring at the sea or wandering in the olive grove, watering the trees with tears. Then one day, Cyprian returned to the tower with the goats to see that the girl had laid two places on the table. She ate with him that night and every night after. She cooked and cleaned and tended the tower, all as her mother had taught her. She began to work in the taverna again, a few hours a week, though her smile was not so sweet as before, and her tips not so generous. Cyprian tossed the dark green 12-gauge shell out to sea and traded the young man's pack and clothing to a neighbor who could be trusted. And at night, while the girl walked the hillside, he sat on his terrace and drank the last of the ouzo, raising his glass to the unconquerable Mani.
Thank you, Leslie, for that reading. We're recording this podcast at the Malice Domestic Conference in Bethesda, a conference that celebrates traditional and cozy mysteries. Leslie, while I have you here, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about how you came to write your story, The End of the Line.
Sure. My husband and I were traveling in Greece, and we took a trip down into the Mani Peninsula, which is the southernmost tip of Greece, really the southernmost tip of Europe, except for some of the islands. And the year before we were there, there had been tremendous wildfires in the olive groves, and you could still see scorching on the sides of some of the famous stone towers, particularly in the village called Vathia, which is right at the very tip of the Mani Peninsula overlooking the Mediterranean. We were walking through Vathia, and I looked down, and on the ground, on the dirt trail, was a spent shotgun shell. And I wondered, how the heck did that get here? So this story is one answer to that question.
That's great. Your novel, A Salt and Pepper, debuts a second series for you. Can you tell us about this book and this series?
Sure. A Salt and Pepper is the first in my Seattle Spice Shop mysteries. My main character, Pepper Reese, acquired her nickname as a child long before she bought the spice shop in Seattle's famous Pike Place Market. But running the shop has given her a new zest for life, until she finds a dead man on her doorstep and a key employee is charged with his murder. It will be followed in December of 2015 by Guilty as Cinnamon.
That's a nice title.
They're fun. We have a lot of fun with these titles.
You also have going another culinary series, the Food Lovers Village series, which takes place in Montana. What distinguishes the two series for you?
So the Food Lover's Village mysteries are set in a fictional town called Jewel Bay, which is a resort community, lakeside resort community on the road to Glacier National Park. And while it's fictional, it does have roots in some of the real towns that surround Flathead Lake and dot the mountains of western Montana. The Spice Shop mysteries are set in Pike Place Market, which is, of course, a very real place. It's been there since 1907, and there's a lot of history. So one big difference is between writing rural and writing urban. Another is between writing a place that is mostly a place of the imagination, a place of the heart, and a place that actually exists. Probably the setting is for me the biggest difference. And it's the thing that most makes the series come alive for me. You can probably tell by the story I just read that setting is really important to me. So writing an urban cozy like the Spice Shop Mysteries is a little bit different than a rural cozy, because in a small town, most people know each other. And when you're a shopkeeper in the village and you go to the grocery store, you run into all kinds of people you know. You know nearly everyone there. But when you're a shopkeeper in downtown Seattle and you go home to another neighborhood, Pepper lives downtown, but if, for example, you lived in another neighborhood and you go into a grocery store, you might not see anybody you knew, because your work and your home are different. They're different places, and you have corresponding circles, but they're not, or intersecting circles, excuse me, but they're not going to be the same. So the cast of characters and the things you run into, the people you run into, differs a little bit. The two women who are my main characters are a little bit different too. Pepper in the Spice Shop Mysteries is in her early 40s. She's divorced. She lives in a downtown loft. And she bought the Spice Shop after the year from, well, the year when everything fell apart, when she came across her husband, a Seattle police officer, practically plugging the meter of a parking enforcement officer in a local restaurant, and left him, and then bought the loft. And then shortly after that, her job as an HR manager in a law firm disappeared when the law firm imploded in scandal. And so she naturally bought the Spice Shop. I mean, what else do you do when your job disappears, right? Erin Murphy, the protagonist in my Montana series, the Food Lover's Village series, is a local girl come home. And that's a common story. That's my story, too. And it's a very frequent experience for us. We leave Montana for greener pastures, and then we come back home to the place that shaped us. So they're different, but they both love food and dead bodies.
And you, too. You love to cook?
I do. I do. Mostly I love to eat.
So, you are also an attorney who writes and blogs about legal issues for crime fiction writers. So what sorts of things do you feel like mystery writers need to know?
Well, I occasionally do presentations for writers on the 10 most common mistakes that fiction writers make about the law. And I will say that hands down, the most common one is using the wrong terms. Referring to the prosecutor as the DA or the district attorney in a location that calls its prosecutors by some other term. Another one is giving every suspect a Miranda warning. Recently, I have read a number of books or seen some TV shows where the police officers warn a witness not to leave town. You can't really do that. Here's another one that I've seen a number of times recently. It's using bail as punishment rather than to ensure that the suspect appears for trial. And another one that's caught my attention recently is the idea that it's up to the victim whether to press charges. And it's not. It's not up to the victim. It's up to the prosecutors, by whatever term they're called.
Great.
So those are some of the most common mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again, Leslie, for reading The End of the Line. The story is from the December 2006 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Our magazine is published 10 times a year by Dell Magazines. To learn more about us, visit our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand, and digital versions are available from Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Magster, Sony, and on Google Play. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.